This podcast contains adult content.
Some of the themes or topics may include
information on murder, kidnapping,
torture, dismemberment,
maybe some demonic content,
with information on possessions
and paranormal activity.
This podcast will also include explicit,
horrible and foul,
socially unacceptable,
totally uninhibited,
adult themes language.
So if you're easily offended,
if you're easily triggered,
then I highly suggest you turn this off now, and if not, just keep in mind,
parental discretion is advised.
Today we're going to be talking about Alexander Salonik, sometimes pronounced Salonika, who was a Russian gangster known for his reputation as a notorious hitman in the Russian criminal underworld. He was also known as Alexander Maximov, the Macedonian, Sasha the Macedonian, Sasha the Great, Killer Number One, the Kurgan Rambo, and most famously, he went by the Super Killer. Before we get going with today's episode, I do have to give a shout out to new Patreon subscribers. We have Kiki H, Elena Edmondson, and Terry White. Thank you so much for your Patreon pledges. I hope you're enjoying that bonus content. We have about 150 episodes on Patreon that are not on the regular feed. You also get ad-free episodes on Patreon as well, and all of it is $2 a month. So if you want to subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/mysterious circumstances. Bam, $2 a month. You have access to all of that. Really don't have any other news besides that. So let's go ahead and get on with the episode. Alright, so Alexander Viktorovich Salonik was born October 16th, 1960 in Kurgan, Soviet Union. There are a lot of things that are still kind of unclear about his life, but here is what we do know. He came from a regular working class family, just like any other kid in that area at the time. As a teenager, he really loved and got into sports, especially classic wrestling, guns, and sport shooting, and he was a very ambitious young man. He was only about 5'5", which is 165 centimeters tall. Like almost all short men, he had that problem to where he felt, you know, he had to compensate. So this dude would fucking fight anybody at any given time. He also grew up in the same neighborhood as Andrei Kolagov, who would become one of the leaders of the Kurgan criminal organization. And they were friends growing up. And this is one of the reasons Alexander had joined the group in the future. When he finished school, he went to construction school and became a welder, and then Salonik was conscripted into the Soviet Army. Different sources tell different stories about his time in the Army. Story one, which is the most likely story, is that he was assigned to a tank regiment, part of the group of Soviet forces in Germany, and he became a squad commander and commanded some tanks. He did a lot of wrestling and shooting competitions while in the army. Story number two is that he served in a special unit of the Central Intelligence Department, which was attached to a group of Soviet troops in East Germany. They were called Little Red Devils, and it was rumored that the Soviet Union trained these guys specifically just to kill senior officials in NATO countries. Story number three is that he served in a sports company where he proved himself as an excellent athlete. He was great at cross country and wrestling, but he was really bad at shooting, which is really weird. And that's why we don't really believe this story, because Alexander Salonik was a very good sports shooter when he was a teenager. And as we're going to come to find out, he also was in the future as well. Alexander Salonik's former lawyer, Valery Kereshev, said, My client served in Germany, but not in the Central Intelligence Department as people think now. There was a group of special intelligence officers trained near the territory of the military unit in which Alexander Solonik served. He would watch those training programs for a lot of time. He even became obsessed with the idea of becoming a Superman. He found something romantic about it. So when he served in the army, he made up his mind to become a cop. And apparently he had gone AWOL from the army, which is one source. Others say that he was discharged after serving his time. But either way, in 1980, after he got out, he went to police school. And he originally served as a patrolman. And around this time, he got married and eventually had a daughter with his first wife. And because of his good work at his job and his qualities, he got a promotion very quickly and went for training at the Gorkovsky Higher School of the Ministry of Internal Affairs. And 6 months later, he was fired. And there are a few different stories about why he was fired. Story number one says it's for discrediting the rank of a police officer. Story number two says he was dismissed due to his cruelty towards prisoners. And story number three was that he had assaulted some women. And we really don't know because the authorities probably didn't want to make the story public, so they just got rid of him. And they basically said it was for absenteeism and skipping classes and immoral behavior because apparently he was buying prostitutes and also fucking the boss's wife. So, sometime between 1980 and 1984, him and his first wife got a divorce. In 1984, he got a job in private security with the police. They were understaffed, and he still was really good at what he did. And he ended up getting fired again because he was leaving his post to chase women and go out on dates. At about this time, his old friend that he had grown up with, Andrei Kologov, he offered him a job as a gravedigger in his hometown of Kurgan. So he ends up going back to Kurgan, and he got a job as a gravedigger at the Kurgan Cemetery with Andrei Kologov and two other guys with names that I don't think I can pronounce, so we're just going to skip over them. But these three guys in the near future will become the leaders of the Kurgan criminal organization. And believe it or not, it was really good money being a gravedigger because nobody wanted to do it. So his status started changing noticeably around this time. He buys a nice car, he starts dressing a lot better, and he starts being seen with a lot of girls of easy virtue. And that literally is what they put in quotations. And I'll state my sources at the end of this episode. But I will tell you right now, like, I got most of my information from Russian sources. A lot of that getting translated was not the easiest thing I have ever done. This is actually a super hard episode to research. But anyway, in 1987, at about the age of 26, 27 years old, he got married for the second time and had a son with his second wife. And then in the fall of 1987, he is unexpectedly arrested for suspicion of rape. The fairness of the court's verdict is questioned by a lot of people and is still questioned to this day because they said that the charges were fabricated by a cop whose wife was cheating on him with Alexander Solonik. So basically, this cop went and found a woman that Solonik had slept with in the past, about 6 months prior, and he got her to say that Solonik had raped her. And a lot of people said the investigation didn't even prove his guilt. And they took into consideration the fact that the victim went to police several months after the alleged incident happened. And they also point out that while the investigation was going on into this, Solonik wasn't even in jail during this. He was let out and just told not to leave the area. Now, the cops said that on August 19th, 1987, Solonik brought a girl named Elena to his house and raped her three times that night. And the next day, she went to the police, and a case was opened against him, and then all of a sudden, two more victims appeared. One of the other victims said he raped her 7 times in one night and beat her. And when he wasn't looking, she allegedly broke out a window in his apartment and took off running. And like I said, there are a lot of weird little things going on with this whole case against him. And we'll actually talk about him a little bit more in the future. But in February of 1988, he appears in court for the statements of the victims. And legit, the prosecution had nothing else. They had one victim that provided a statement, and that was it. There was no other evidence against the guy. So Andrei Kologov was one of the witnesses at the trial. That's his friend. And he testified that Solonik was innocent and said that Solonik was with him and some other friends that night and no women were even around. But it did not matter. Alexander Solonik was sentenced to 8 years in a maximum security correctional colony. And when the sentence was announced, he asked for a last hug from his wife, and his wife came in to see him. And this is when his first escape happens, first escape of many. He realized he had nothing to lose. He knew that if he went to prison, he would die, mainly because he was an ex-cop. And all of a sudden, he pushed the guards away, he broke out a window in the meeting room where he was with his wife, and he jumped off the second story of the building and escaped, and the cops really didn't even look for him that long. They were just kind of like, well, you know, he escaped, we looked for him for a little bit, but whatever. So Alexander Solonik disappeared for about 6 weeks, and he had reached the Siberian city of Tiumen. And this is about 120 miles or 190 kilometers north of Kurgan. While he was there, he decided to get rid of a mole on his face and a crown-like tattoo on his arm. And while he's in the plastic surgeon's office, he is arrested right there in the office. So they gave him 4 more years for escaping on top of his 8. And he started serving his time in Perm. Former police officers are usually sent to special colonies, but Alexander was sent to a regular one. And at first he was in solitary confinement. This was to protect him from the other prisoners because he had served in the army, he was a cop, and he had a conviction for rape. All three of these are like death sentences in a maximum security prison in Russia. Eventually, he was later transferred to serve his sentence with the other inmates and general population. And as soon as the other prisoners found out who he was and what he did, he was marked for death. And they decided to test this dude's fighting abilities and pretty much just beat him to death. According to all accounts, this fight was a long fight and it was a brutal one. And it was Alexander Solonik against 10 to 12 well-built prisoners. And most accounts did say that he had a broomstick as a weapon. And he won the fight. Like, he was beaten really, really bad, but he did not die and ended up winning. And he was in the hospital for a while after this, and he ended up getting 20 stitches. I'm not sure where, but that's what the sources say. Weirdly enough, after that, the prisoners respected him, and they just kind of left him alone, because he had took all of them on. Like, he did not back down. It's fucking crazy, right? And trust me, like, this dude's story just gets crazier as we go. While he was in prison, he was not like the other prisoners there. He didn't smoke cigarettes, he didn't do drugs, he didn't get tattoos. He kept away from other prisoners who were always fighting with the guards and didn't want to work or do anything like that. He just separated himself from all of that. One of the very few things that he did like to do while he was in prison was work out. Eventually, he was transferred to a different colony altogether, which was a minimum security prison, which wasn't guarded as well, and he ended up building a really good relationship with the guards in the minimum security prison. And in April of 1990, after 2 years in prison, Solonik used that as an opportunity and escaped again. A prison dog and inquiry eventually determined that Alexander Salonik escaped from a small air vent hole in the industrial area of the prison. And apparently he had cut a hole with a welding torch. Some sources say it was a sewer pipe and that he dug a hole about 2 meters deep, which is roughly 6.5 feet. And after that, he walked for a little bit over half a mile, which is about a kilometer. And it wasn't hard for him either because he wasn't a big guy. Again, he was only like 5'5", so he could maneuver around these little areas. And then he disappears for roughly 4.5 years until the massacre in Moscow Petrovsky Marketplace, which we will get to here in a little bit. Andrew Salonik makes his way back to his hometown of Kurgan, and the crime family there got him an apartment and a fake identity right off the bat. And he became an active member and somewhat of a leader of that local organization as well. And because he needed money fast, he started his work as a hitman. Now, according to his own testimony, which he gave a lot later, he committed his first serious crime as a member of that group when the top dogs ordered him to kill the leader of another criminal group known as the Ishim. I'm not sure if that's how it's pronounced. It's I-S-H-I-M. So on July 3rd, 1990, roughly 6 weeks after his escape, the assassination took place in Tiemen. And another source does say he didn't do any hits there. And the only trouble that he really got into while he was there was a bar fight with another gangster. Either way, after this hit, Salonik goes to Moscow with other members of the Kurgan group to seek more work because his freedom is costing him a lot of money right now. So he gets to Moscow, and his main qualifications for work as a hired killer are his military service, his time in prison, outstanding physical health, and his shooting ability. In Moscow is where he got the nickname Alexander the Great, or the Macedonian, because of his ability to shoot in the Macedonian way, which is with two hands accurately and simultaneously. And as it turned out, there were a lot of people in Moscow who were willing to pay for Salonik's talents, as so to speak. And this price was upwards of six figures sometimes. He was in demand, and it came at a really good time for Russia in this period in the 90s, because the redistribution of property took place at all levels at this time. There's outright criminals that are just working really closely with serious businessmen. Because of that, most people knew they were working together, so high levels of law enforcement were also involved in all this. They said that sometimes it was impossible to understand where everything was according to the law and where everything was according to concepts. In the news every day, you saw reports of military operations, shootings, explosions, kidnappings, contract killings, murders, everything. Now, just for reference, when we talk about a thief in law, that is, by definition, a thief with code in the Soviet Union and the post-Soviet states. It's a formal and special status of criminal authority, a professional criminal who follows certain criminal traditions and enjoys an elite position among other members within organized crime and correctional facility environments, and who has informal authority over lower status members. So essentially, a thief in law is like a made guy in the mafia. Now, at this point in time, the entire country and Moscow in general is in complete chaos. There are killers for hire everywhere. And one source that is the rbth.com Russia Beyond, it's a phenomenal source for Russian history during the 90s and especially 1990s Russian gangsters. They said you could hire somebody to kill anybody you wanted for like $500. Crazy as shit. And at that time, Moscow, from 1990 to 1995, the population was right around 9 million. The highest level of murders was registered in Moscow, which was more than 2,000 per year, along with 94,000 crimes that were reported just in 1995 alone. the first quarter of 1994 averaged 84 murders a day in the city of Moscow. Most of these murders were contract killings by criminal organizations. In total, there were 87,000 murders that year among 9 million people. And just for reference, 1994 in New York City, population was 7.3 million, and the entire city was 2,200 murders that year. That's how fucking wild 1990s Russia and Moscow was. It was legit like the Wild West out there. So in the winter of 1992, Salonik assassinates Russian thief in law Viktor Nikiforov. On August 10th, 1993, he murders another important Russian mob boss, thief in law Valery Dlugach. His nickname was Globus, and he was from the Bauman criminal group. Globus was shot in the heart by a sniper rifle from 44 yards away, which is about 40 meters, while he was walking out of a crowded nightclub, surrounded by bodyguards and getting into his armored car. January 17, 1994, Salonik eliminated Vladislav Viner, who was Globus's replacement, and he was killed the exact same way. He was described in this time as being very daring. He was very lively. He was a very cheerful guy. He was still young. He had spent money easily, and he knew how to please. So people who knew him said that Salonik could easily spend several thousand dollars if he wanted to try to impress a girl. These women surrounded him constantly everywhere he went. In everyday life, restaurants, vacations. Salonik had a photo album that was just filled with pictures of him with these extremely beautiful women that a lot of them were considered models. Now, another one of his hobbies was his passion for weapons. He could talk about this shit for hours. He could talk about rate of fire, reliability, combat range. He even bought himself a machine, which would probably have been like a mill or a lathe, to his Moscow apartment, and he put it in there so he could customize weapons however he wanted them. Like, he did not fuck around. Those weapons are what made him famous. They made him rich. They also made him a very feared man. He was known to carry suitcases with him everywhere he went. And these suitcases are filled with machine guns, pistols, rifles, and optics for those rifles. At one point, MUR operatives that were following him and trying to bust him, they raided one of his rented apartments and they found an entire arsenal. From what one source said, he was there when they came in, but he disappeared as soon as they got there. And they said he looked like an acrobat jumping from balcony to balcony because he just went out the window and he's just like doing some Jason Bourne type shit. But in this apartment, they found trunks, bags, suitcases, all filled with guns. All these weapons were delivered to Petrovka 38, which I believe is a police precinct. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think it is. So someone who saw all of his stuff said this. He occupied an entire office. Look at the PG grenade launcher, the AKS-74U assault rifle, the French long-range rifle with a silencer, the Mosin rifle, the TT pistols, and the foreign R-61, which was Salonik's favorite 17-round Austrian Glock pistol. There's a Taurus in there. Winchesters were in other trunks. The entire MUR came to look at them because they could not believe it. And that was a freaking quote. Now, another thing that they noticed is that each weapon was in perfect condition. All of them were lubricated. All of them were in excellent working condition. The man knew how to take care of his stuff. Now, by this time in 1994, Salonik had become infamous among the criminal organizations and law enforcement in Russia. Law enforcement was starting to get pretty hot on his trail, and they tried to get him so many times, but Moscow police couldn't stop the guy because, according to them, he had an uncanny ability to disappear quickly. And because he has all this law enforcement after him, In the early spring of 1994, Salonik left for Tiemann again to talk to a guy known as Mammoth, or Mammoth. And his real name was Andre Rura. And he was the leader of the most powerful criminal group in Tiemann. This group was known as the Ten. And Salonik spent a lot of time talking to Mammoth, and he was trying to get paid for a debt that he was owed to a Moscow bank, which was like $1 million. He needed this money fucking bad because he was trying to get out of the country, trying to make sure he could still evade law enforcement. And this debt of $1 million was owed to him. And it was owed to him by a guy named Otari K. And I'm calling him Otari K because his last name I cannot even pronounce. It is ridiculous. So he has Mammoth call Otari K, and he's trying to extort this money. Well, Otari is one of the most powerful Russian mobsters as well. And while Mammoth is on the phone with Otari and trying to get this money, he's like, hey, Salonik's here. He wants his $1 million that's owed to him. And Otari had replied back, and Mammoth just looks at Salonik and says, you're nobody here. So apparently, Salonik was pissed off enough that he killed him several weeks later as revenge. On April 5th, Otari K was killed from a shot from a sniper rifle, and only 5 days later, Mammoth was killed in Tiemann, also by a sniper. But that story of Salonik killing him is questioned. There are people from a different crime family that were convicted in 2008 for Otari K's murder, but those people were allies of the Kurgan group, which is who Salonik belonged to. Otari might have been killed by an Orikovskaya gang hitman known as Alexei, I can't even pronounce his last name, they called him Lesha Soldat, which was Lesha Soldier. So Alexei, he confessed to the crime when he was captured in 2006 and eventually got convicted for it. But it should be noted that Salonik, after this, had returned back to Moscow shortly after Otari's murder, and the special services recorded negotiations in a nightclub between three Kurgan gangsters, which was Salonik and two leaders of the Tiemann group who were opposed to the Ten. They were enemies of the Ten. So, there's a little bit of muddy waters there. Some say Salonik didn't do it, some say he did, but we do know that he was caught on record under surveillance and recorded, and he was hanging out with a group that hated, you know, the Ten, which is the group that the two guys he had killed were from. That brings us to October 6th, 1994, the day of the massacre. Salonik and a fellow criminal were apprehended by Moscow police. They were at the market with bosses of the family who were there doing business. Him and this other guy were hanging out by the cars, and they were there as backup in case anything went down. Now, the cops saw them there, and they thought that they were acting suspicious, just kind of hanging around, you know, not really doing shit. So the cops stopped them for an ID check, and he tells the cops that his name is Maximov. And the cops in the Petrovsky marketplace asked Salonik and his friend to go to the police room. And of course, they didn't argue. They're like, all right, we'll go to the little police station here. The cops were really relaxed with Salonik and this other dude because they said he was just so calm and chill and confident that they were like, well, we don't really think he's doing anything wrong now because of the way he's holding himself. But they did find out who he was, and they handcuffed him. Unfortunately, the police didn't search Salonik that well. He was carrying a raincoat on his arm, and he had a Glock 17 underneath it. And at this point in Alexander Salonik's life, he would rather die than go back to prison. So he opens fire in the police room. Another source said that his buddy was the one that started the shooting. But either way, four policemen were hit, and Salonik goes to run outside, still in handcuffs. And while running out of the market, Salonik shot two security guards and one more police officer. So now he's getting chased by even more cops and security guards. He climbs over this fence, and he was about to reach this little metro station, and a bullet finally got him. And he was seriously wounded in the kidney, but he kept running away until he eventually got cornered. And witnesses at this train station said that he managed to hold back the cops until he passed out from blood loss. And here is the special report from the Moscow GUVD. It says, during a shootout on the territory of the Tias Market near the Petrovsko-Razumovskaya metro station, a criminal who was wounded in the back and identified himself as Maximov was detained. During the operational search activities, it was possible to establish that the detainee was a native of Kurgan, A. Salonik, wanted for committing the contract murder of a thief-in-law, Valery Dlugach, Globus. The arrest was preceded by a banal document check. Later it turned out that Salonik and his Kurgan accomplice, Monin, came to Tias to sort out some business. Now, Salonik's friend ended up escaping. He got away. All in all, 6 people died. 4 of them were cops. 2 of them were security guards. But what makes it crazy is that police officers were astounded with how Alexander Salonik could shoot. They said his shooting ability was like nothing they had ever seen. One other witness said that when Salonik was running away from the cops, he fired his gun over his shoulder 3 times trying to kill an officer who was hiding behind a cement pole. All 3 of the bullets hit the pole in one spot the size of an apple. And this is as he's running away shooting over his shoulder. Pretty crazy shit. So after he's caught, he is sent to Moscow to the Matroskaya Tishina prison, where he has an operation to remove a bullet from his kidney. One source did say that they took the entire kidney out. The cops who detained Salonik said that they were 100% that he's going to die within a day because the wound was super bad. He had lost so much blood. They were like, he's going to die within 24 hours. And he was actually pronounced dead in the hospital after the operation. And he was being moved to the morgue. And the doctor who was in charge of moving the bodies, he was always taught to check for a pulse before they put him in that fucking morgue refrigerator drawer or whatever. And he felt a fucking pulse. And he found out that Salonik was alive, and he ended up getting transferred to the ICU instead of getting sealed up in the morgue. So the day after his arrest, he was reported dead in the papers because technically he did die. He was on his fucking way to the morgue. The Homicide Department of the Russian Ministry of Internal Affairs, this dude named Vladimir Petukhov, he says that we detained a killer, a specialist in thieves in law. He has already confessed to the most notorious murders. Otari K., Kalina, Globus. This has never happened before. That was a quote from him. Now, while Salonik is recovering here, he starts confessing to all kinds of contract murders. He would even go to the sites of the crimes and recreate the events of how these people died. Salonik was confessing to every crime that he knew about, which was 43 contract killings. He was confessing to the ones that he had no part of, just the ones that he knew about too, because he wanted the FSB to investigate his case. This is actually when he got the nickname Killer Number One. Now, the FSB is an organization in Russia that takes care of the security of the country. It is the organization that came after the KGB. Relating to internal affairs inside the country, its main responsibilities are within the country. It does counterintelligence, internal and border security, counterterrorism, and surveillance. It also investigates some other types of serious crimes. The reason he's doing all this confessing and telling about all these crimes and he wants the FSB to investigate his case is because he knows that if he is transferred from an FSB prison to a regular prison, he is going to die. There are inmates in any of those prisons that were associates with Nikiforov, Venner, Globus. He has killed a lot of like mafia bosses. So all these underlings and all these people associated with these different families, they want him dead along with law enforcement. So he's confessing to all this shit so that he can stay safe in an FSB prison. One of the reasons that they don't think he committed a lot of these murders is because he didn't know the weapons that were used in most of them, but he still knew exactly how they happened. So he was very valuable, and they did keep him separated and safe. While he's in prison right now, recovering, he starts divorce proceedings from his second wife. And also at this time, which is crazy, his lawyer finds out that his original rape case was completely fabricated. Him and Salonik wanted to go to court so that Salonik could get his name cleared. Because if he can get his name cleared from those charges that put him in prison in the first place, then basically a lot of the other shit might be kind of null and void. I don't see how that is even a possibility after he's admitted to 43 contract fucking murders at this point in time. But Andrei Kologov, his friend from childhood, at this point, Kologov is super huge. And if you remember, he was an original witness that testified on behalf of Salonik in the first trial. He said he would never go to court for testimony ever again because of two reasons. One, Kologov himself had just had an investigation opened up on him. Another reason is because Salonik's name is all over the country right now, because this dude is just wild as shit. He's all over the news and across the entire country. So Kologov is like, listen, our names cannot be fucking seen in the same sentence. This is not going to be good, man. So Kologov gives Salonik's lawyer the order to not ask him any more questions. Meaning the lawyer can't talk to Kologov anymore. And so the lawyer goes back to Salonik to be like, hey, Kologov said basically you're on your own, dude. He's not going to testify in court because of all the other shit that's going on right now. And Salonik at this time, he's already pissed because Valeri, his lawyer, wasn't visiting him as much as he should have. He wasn't representing him the way that Salonik thought he should. Now, because Kologov wouldn't testify to help Salonik, that meant that the deal between the prosecution and the defense was immediately terminated, which sucks for Salonik. He's got all this other shit going on. But I will say, eventually, Salonik's lawyer did get the absolute shit beat out of him by members of the Kurgan group, probably because of that. So, Salonik's recovering in prison from his whole kidney thing, taking the bullet. And he keeps working out. He starts studying more foreign languages and computers. He's just biding his time, and he's learning as much as he can while he's in there. And he's essentially waiting for all of his friends on the outside to break him out of prison. And that's exactly what happens on June 5th, 1995. Some sources say July 5th, 1995, 8 months after his capture. The thing is the investigation into Salonik's confessions is almost done. He knows that there's a trial coming real soon. And while he's been in prison this 8 months, you know, he starts thinking about his life. He's like, you know what? Maybe I should just get the fuck out of Russia, get a new identity, start over somewhere, whatever. Just quit this shit. So after a supposed 43 hits, the contract killer kind of decides that he's just, you know, might be done with the mob. And keep in mind, too, he's also injured at this point. He's still recovering. One day, Salonik asks for a catalog, and he orders himself a Versace suit, a shirt and tie, and glasses. And he didn't even need glasses. He had 20/20 vision, but he thought glasses made him look more professional and impressive. Which, you know, probably partially true. Shortly after that, he became the only person to escape from Moscow's Matroskaya Tishina Penitentiary Pre-Trial Detention Center 1. This place had alarms, video cameras, bugs, listening devices everywhere. There is no square inch of that prison that is unmonitored at any given time. Salonik hid some clothes under his blanket to make the guards think that he was sleeping, and one of the guards, a guy named Sergei Menshikov, He supplied Salonik with a rope, climbing gear, and guns. And Menshikov took him to the roof of the jail, where Salonik rappelled down on a rope and got into a BMW car that was waiting for him there. His escape was supposedly funded by the Russian mafia. So the late Russian Ministry of Internal Affairs detective named Vladimir Tishke, he explained off the record, "The theoretical hype around climbing equipment and rappelling from the roof is nonsense. Both Salonik and the prison guard Menshikov, who was helping him, calmly walked out through the vestibule of the prison entrance. For that kind of money, they not only open the doors, but can, if desired, carry them in their arms to the car." But this is the official report from the criminal case. It says, "In pretrial detention center 1, prison, Matroskaya, Tishina, Salonik was registered as prone to escape. He was kept in solitary confinement cell number 938 of special block number 9. When inspecting the floor of building number 9, Sergeant S. found the passage doors leading to the roof open. There was a broken door lock on the floor. On the roof, at the edge of the exercise yards, a cord was found, the end of which, about 20 meters long, hung from the roof of the building along the outside, the pretrial detention center 1, on Tishina Street." So, one thing we do know is that the guard Menshikov, by himself, could not have organized all this, alright? It is now known that Orakovsky crime family, who were the allies of the Kurgan group, they allocated $1 million for Salonik's escape. $500,000 was spent on safe houses and about $250,000 to the guard and helping him get out of the country. Salonik knew he had pissed off a lot of crime families at this point, and he fucking knew too much. And they knew that if he decided to talk at any given time, everybody is going to be fucked. And that's why the group paid so much to get him out of prison. They're like, listen, we'll pay $1 million to get him out of there so he can be our worry. And we know he's not going to talk, or at least going to turn us in or whatever. So the government was also looking for Salonik. He knows that if he gets caught, he's getting the death penalty for killing the cops at that marketplace. So he is in a really, really bad spot right now, as which he should be. I'm not trying to glorify anything this guy is doing, obviously. But law enforcement ended up blocking off train stations, airports, any exit from the city that there was, and they even detained people that looked like him. But his whereabouts were absolutely unknown. Salonik does not have very many hiding places in Russia. He's known to law enforcement, he's known to the general public, so there ends up being an apartment rented for him at one point in the Vladimir region, and this is while he's still recovering from his wounds, man, taking that bullet to the kidneys or having his kidney removed, whichever source is correct. And his neighbors would eventually testify that Kurgan leaders from the criminal group would come to visit him at this apartment. And one of them was an intelligence officer by the name of Alexander Litvinenko, which, if you do not know that name, look that up real quick. I'll describe him here in a minute, but Litvinenko actually helped put together the Kurgan crime family. Now, Litvinenko had died on November 23rd, 2006. He was a British naturalized Russian defector and former officer of the Russian Federal Security Service, which was the FSB, who specialized in tackling organized crime. Now, at one point, the Kurgan Brigade, which is what they were known as, visited him with Litvinenko, and they were asking for his help with a businessman by the name of Andrei Lukashov. Lukashov was the general director of the St. Petersburg company called Socrates, and they traded in food products. And the company was doing really, really good. He was the director, and he wants to sell the company and move to Spain. He's like, hey, I created a successful company. I'm going to take my money, go live my days off in Spain. So one of the Kurgan guys wanted to buy this company and he wanted to get it for a really good price. And apparently, Lukashov refused this guy's offer. And we know that because the deal just never happened. Because on September 20th, 1996, Lukashov was shot in St. Petersburg. He did end up surviving. Now, after recovering, the businessman went to Moscow with his wife, and they were going to finalize selling the business to someone else and then leave for Spain. And this is when he dies. Apparently, Salonik saw him walking, and basically it was a drive-by shooting in a Volkswagen. He had hit Lukashov in the back, and he fell down, and then they shot him more while he was on the ground, and this car never even stopped. It never even came. They just kept on going. And witnesses called an ambulance and some cops and got him to the hospital for surgery. He died soon after he arrived at the hospital. So we do know that Salonik had lived for some time in Kiev after this. He was also seen in Spain, Italy, and Cyprus. And he was still seen around in Moscow as well. Apparently, he was seen a couple times in the state building. So they were looking for him, but he didn't really even hide. He had plastic surgery that basically changed the shape of his face. And then more and more stories start coming out in the press. For example, it's said that after his escape, Salonik allegedly moved to his native Kurgan, where he lived for some time under the protection of special forces. And only then, after waiting to receive a Greek passport under the name Vladimir Kesov, left for Athens, Greece. Now, there are some questions we have here. He had passports, IDs of an employee of the military prosecutor's office, and other fake documents. Where did these come from? Who helped him? The Kurgan group rented a villa for him in Athens, and the guard, Menshikov, was with him this entire time. And to be honest, the only reason Menshikov is even probably alive right now is because he's with Salonik. But how does a criminal group get him IDs of an employee of the military prosecutor's office? Like, that's crazy shit, right? So, we're about at the halfway point. I'm going to stop, play some commercials here for a minute, and you can either hit the fast forward button, stop, take a break, grab a beer. I will meet you back here in a few. So about 4 to 6 weeks after his escape, he arrives in Greece. When he gets to Greece, Alexander Salonik set up his own organization of around 50 men. They were suspected of drug trafficking and more contract killings. His reputation grew to legendary status with the public, and he was featured in Russia's top 10 most wanted list. His mansion had a basketball court, golf course, and a garden filled with sculptures. As luck would have it, there were a lot of Russian girls in Greece. They would go there from all over the former USSR. They would work in nightclubs, cheap stores, and according to a guy named Kostya Grek, not a week passed without another dancer or waitress appearing at Villa Salonika. But Sasha was also a romantic. He was looking for a princess. Around September-October 1996, people from Moscow and the Kurgan group started going to see him a lot. There were also members of the Orekovskaya group and other allied groups as well going to visit him. The Kurgan crime family had the whole place wired. They were the one paying for this fucking mansion. So they totally laced it with bugs everywhere. And they knew what everyone was saying about everyone, no matter where they were in this place. Salonik's friends kept telling him that he needs to leave because of all the shit that he knew, like he was gonna eventually get killed. But Salonik also had no money at this time. The Kurgan group was paying for everything, and Salonik was in debt to them. On top of that, a colonel in the RUOF wanted Salonik to die because one of the cops that was killed in the marketplace shootout was a friend of his. Salonik had bought some maps of some European countries at this time, mainly Germany, Spain, and Italy, and he studied them for a long time. His Greek passport gave him free entry to almost any of these countries. There were lots of recordings from the wiretaps about murders. Basically, all sides of all these criminal groups were working together to get rid of Alexander Salonik. Most often, Salonik would go away to Italy. The Kurgan group would invite him there and talk to him, and he was more than likely doing some work there for him as well. He usually returned back home to Greece in a good mood. Sometimes he would throw a small friendly party while he was drinking only expensive dry wine. Now, while he's taking these trips, headlines would appear in the newspapers. For example, Chakro Sr. was killed in Germany. Another major authority was killed in Italy. I tried looking up some of this information and I could not find anything. I'm not saying that the info isn't out there, but it was hard enough finding Russian information on Alexander Salonik, let alone diving into other countries and doing those translations as well. So the big question is, did he have enough time for each one of these contract killings, though? Because Salonik always prepared each operation painstakingly and carefully. He was very meticulous. He would track each of his victims for a very long period of time, and he would try to collect as much information as possible about his target. He would study the person's working day, their habits, their weaknesses. Along with that, in most cases, he did not work alone. Salonik had a certain cover, and someone always was there to back him up. Many of the operations were planned by completely different people as well. And sometimes he would receive an order, and then it would get canceled. For example, when he was ordered to kill Otari K, but then the hit was given to someone else at the last minute. In November-December 1996, he went to Moscow under somebody else's name. Either at a presentation or in a nightclub is when he first saw, apparently, the woman of his dreams. Her name was Svetlana Kutova. She was known as Sveta. He had found out that she was a fashion model for the Red Star agency. He ended up getting her phone number because he wanted her bad. And according to neighbors, at this time, Salonik lived with a woman named Natasha, who was considered his wife. She worked in a fur shop in the center of Athens. He often would come to pick her up after work and give her expensive gifts, which earrings and rings, which she would be showing off to her friends and shit. And journalists believe these neighbors were talking about the famous fashion model Natalia Liena. She was also in Greece at this time, and surprisingly enough, allegedly returned to Russia in a hurry after the death of Alexander Salonik. And in later interview with Salonik's lawyer backs up what these journalists said as well. Now, towards the end of January 1997, Moscow fashion model, multiple winner of prestigious beauty contests, Svetlana Kutova, arrived in Athens to go to a beauty pageant in Italy. According to her relatives, Sveta, as she was known, was promised a high-paying job and participation in advertising photo shoots by a certain Valera, who called from Greece. And the special services knew that Salonik was hiding under the name Valera. Sveta called home several times and said that she had settled in the suburbs of the capital, Langonisi, and this is where Salonik had lived. At this point, it didn't matter, because Salonik, he really didn't have much time left. Police found out one of the last calls before she disappeared was made by her to Salonik's villa. The night before he was killed, Sveta called Moscow and said that she was leaving for filming the next morning, and then she was not seen for a while after that. She completely disappeared. Now, from the testimony of Lesha Soldier, or Lesha Soldat, here's what he said happened that night. We met Salonik in Greece. A trusting relationship had developed between us. During the conversation, Salonik told me about some of the crimes he had committed. The murder of thief-in-law, Kalina, a murder with a sniper rifle near the Globus Entertainment Center, an attempt on Boban's life, The authority of the rival Bauman group, Boban, and his bodyguard Globin were shot in a jeep when they arrived at the shooting range on a highway. Salonik explained that after the arrest, he was placed in a single cell and thought that he would die. He didn't care, and he took upon himself everything that was tried onto him. When he began to recover, he became withdrawn and refused to give evidence. Apparently, he had been collecting info on Salonik for a while on behalf of a few different criminal groups. A bunch of different crime families who also had surveillance in the villas wanted to take him out as well. His every single move was tracked, and the villas where Salonik spent time, like I said earlier, were full of bugs. The leaders knew everything that Sasha the Great was doing. So, from the info on the criminal case, it is known that the command for his death was given by the leaders of the Empire, the Mafia structure, which was one of the organized crime groups, and it was given by two guys, Sergei Butorin and Oleg Pilev. They did not like Alexander Salonik at all. He was independent and knew too much about too many things. And to be honest with you, these two guys, looking back, probably should have been scared of Salonik, because later on, in the basement of one of the villas he rented, Salonik had hung their pictures of these two separate leaders in his basement, which was adapted for a shooting range, and he was using them as targets. So I'm pretty sure Salonik was planning on taking these dudes out before they took him out. Now, Butorin was a Russian gangster suspected of at least 20 murders. He rose to power in the Wild West of 1990s Russia. He would run protection rackets with the extremely violent Orekhovo gang, which they were allies with the Kurgan group. His best-known victim is known as Alexander Superkiller Salonik. Facing a crackdown from authorities, Butorin fled the country. He got arrested for illegal weapons trafficking in Spain in 2001. He had allegedly undergone plastic surgery and organized his own funeral in Russia to fake his own death. He was eventually sentenced to life in prison by a Moscow court, and that was a report from the Associated Press. Now, at this point, gangsters are after Salonik. Special services are after Salonik. You have cops that are after him. The FSB is after him. As messed up as this sounds, it was easier for the leaders of the Empire to kill him because they wanted him gone. And a lot of these law enforcement agencies figured that the Russian mafia would get to him first. So they're just kind of like, well, you know, we're not really going to stop him, you know, if they do go after him, or if they decide to go after him sometime soon, because that's going to solve our problem. But Alexander Salonik was not an easy person to get a hold of. He was known as the super killer for a reason. He escaped from prison three times. Salonik knew all these people were after him, but what could he do about it? He understood the fact that the Russian mafia wanted him dead. You know, there was nothing he could do about that except try to kill them first. And as a side fact, the murder of Salonik was actually the starting point of the investigation into the Medvedkovsky family, which it was kind of like a RICO case. Like, the RICO Act type shit had never really been done in USSR or in Russia before this. So he was actually the guy who started that shit. That's kind of shitty. Fuck him, right? So because of law enforcement and other gangsters working against Salonik, they had started to get all the info on Andrei Kolagov as well, his old childhood friend. And they all realized that if Salonik was taken alive by law enforcement, he would be able to talk and he would probably bring down half a dozen crime families just on his own from what he knew. And that's why they sent Sasha Soldier, or Lacia Soldier, and a group of guys from Orekhovsky crime family to Greece to kill Salonik, because they were allies with the Kurgan group and they were friendly with Salonik. He kind of trusted them. They knew that they had to get there first and kill him before the RUOP or law enforcement got to him. Now let's talk a little bit about his death. So again, Salonik made a lot of enemies. And on January 31st, 1997, Russian hitman and ex-Marine Alexander Pustovalov, who is known as Sasha Soldat, he strangled Alexander Salonik to death in Salonik's villa. Salonik had welcomed Soldat with open arms and started to talk to him. With his back turned to his buddy, Soldat wrapped a thin cord around his neck and strangled him to death. Soldat and his men from the Kurgan Syndicate killed Salonik's girlfriend too. They almost didn't kill them that night because she was with him, but both of them got offed. In 2005, Pustovalov was sentenced to 23 years in prison for gang activity, committing 5 murders and 1 attempted murder. In 2016, he got 24 more years for another murder. Investigators believe that the Orekhovo gang committed no less than 50 murders and murder attempts in Moscow City, Moscow, and Vladimir regions, Greece, and Ukraine. The most notorious hits include the murder of the head of the Foundation for Social Support to Athletes, who was Otari K, in 1994, the murder in Greece of infamous hitman Alexander Salonik and his girlfriend Svetlana Kotova, and the murder of major crimes police investigator Yuri Karez in 1998. So, like, these motherfuckers were no joke, dude. They would kill fucking anybody. And yes, I do realize that I keep going back between Orekhovsky and Orekhovo. Depending on the publication and the translation, there are a lot of words that are spelled differently. And I did the best I could. It is what it is. So I'm just reading it as the information is presented. And some of the translations are a little bit off. So on February 2nd, 1997 is when the entire world learned about the death of superkiller Alexander Salonik. The Greek press reported that the dead body of the head of the Russian mafia was found 20 kilometers from Athens. Salonik died of choking. As usual, there are several different versions that talk about how he died and all that shit, but it's believed that someone called the police and said that there was a dead body of an unknown man found in that forest, and it was said that the body was hidden in that bag, and police determined that the man was choked with an electrical cord. Now, although he was wearing clothes, no identification was found in the dead man's pockets. His fingerprints and other data were put into the computer, and because he was on the federal wanted list, that's when they found out that it was the man known as Kurgan Rambo, or Killer Number One. One news agency reported later that the prison guard that helped him escape, Sergei Menshikov, that his dead body was found in the Yauza River. But the next day, the same news agency totally retracted that information. Here's what the wire service report said. Salonik, 37, accused of murdering 4 Moscow policemen 2 years ago, was found Sunday strangled and wrapped in plastic bags 20 kilometers north of Athens. Salonik, known as Sasha Makedonsky, Alexander the Great of Macedonia, because of his reputed skill with weapons, has been accused of numerous contract killings of Russian criminal bosses, a source in Russia's Interior Ministry said Tuesday. Salonik escaped from Matruskaya Tishina prison while under investigation for his involvement in a shooting at the Petrovsko market in 1995, in which 4 policemen were killed. The escape was set up by a guard, Sergeant Sergei Menshikov, who is still at large. Antenna, a private Athens television station, said Salonik was connected to the KGB before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russian police denied reports that the body found in Greece has already been identified positively as Alexander Salonik by Russian experts. Mikhail Doronin of the Interior Ministry Press Office said that so far Russian police are relying only on information coming from Greece. He denied published reports that a team of Russian police had gone to Greece to conduct an investigation and said it was far too early to comment on the exact cause of death. He said the body will have to be brought to Russia and be examined first. Interfax reported that authorities could try to identify the body by searching for a syringe that was left in Salonik's body by a surgeon in 1995 when the gunman's kidney was removed to save him from a wound suffered in the Petrovsko shootout. Fucking left a fucking syringe in him. Could you imagine? Anyway, Moscow Internal Affairs Department said that the story was a little bit different. They said a plane from Frankfurt, Germany, landed in one of Moscow's airports. Greek citizen Mr. Kalandopoulos arrived on board that plane in Moscow. This person was also known as Andrei Kologov, a leader of Kurgan-based criminal group. The police were waiting for him at the mentioned airport, and he was questioned and didn't say anything. But they did find out that Kologov recently had a meeting with Salonik in Athens, so a group of police officers left for Athens right away. In the Greek airport, the chief of the police group learned from a phone conversation with Moscow that a parcel was waiting for them at the nearest gas station. The parcel was found there. It was opened the next day by Interpol agents. The package contained the handmade map of some place. On the paper, written in Russian, it said, "You wanted Salonik? Go get him." And this is because Sasha Soldier was told to draw a map of where his body was for the RUOP. An international group of police officers arrived at the place, which was shown on the map not far from the Greek town of Varibovi. A police officer who saw Salonik before recognized his body. It just so happened that Salonik had choked right after the police officers left for Greece, and this was based on the time of death. After he died, police found three villas in Langonisi, which were rented by Salonik and his people. During a search, an AK-47 assault rifle, ammunition, a bunch of money, bank checks, and fake identification were found in one of them. So, because of all this information, a lot of people are like, okay, so what about his fucking girlfriend, Sveta? So, her name didn't appear in any police reports, it didn't appear on the news. There were people who reportedly saw her leaving the country, but nobody knew where she went. Law enforcement at the time said Sveta was 100% alive, but was probably very scared and therefore in hiding. So here are some of the rumors about his death. So it was rumored his double was actually killed in Greece and not him, and they took into consideration the fact that his face could not be recognized after he had plastic surgery, which would make sense because if he was seen at one of the state buildings in Moscow and nobody had arrested him or recognized him, then apparently the plastic surgery might have been good. Or he had really, really, really good connections outside of the criminal organizations. It was also said that Salonik's fingerprints in the Interpol database were not actually his fingerprints, but they were his double's fingerprints. So, when they say that his body double was the dead body that was found, yeah, if they run his fingerprints, those are what's going to show up as him. Now, Salonik's lawyer, Valery Karishev, who attended the police identification and burial, said that the dead man had little similarity to his former client. Salonik's mother, who identified the corpse as her son's body, did not attend the funeral. The detective who knew more than others about Salonik's fate and his ins and outs discovered his body in Athens and organized the examination to identify the body. This guy was an operative of the capital's RUBOP, and his name was Andrei Saratov. Oddly enough, he unexpectedly died in a car accident not long after he was the one who identified the body. Now, in the weeks after Salonik's body was found, when the Greek authorities raided the villas belonging to Salonik's group, they found arsenals of weapons. They also discovered that Salonik had recently been hired to carry out a hit in Italy before his death. And here is from the testimony of a man known as the Liquidator, and he was Sasha Soldier. He says, "Let me explain that Pelev is the leader and leader of the Medvedkovo or Akov group. It was he who decided who should live and who should die. Oleg Pelev explained that there would be work in Greece. You need to go on a business trip and deal with Salonik. Work with a rope. I understood that Pylev meant the murder of Salonik by strangulation. I prepared the cord for the electric iron in advance. In the evening, Salonik came to us with a girl. Gusev, seizing the moment, threw Salonik face down on the floor, and I put a cord around his neck and began to choke him until he stopped showing signs of life. The girl began to scream. They hit her, after which she lost consciousness. Later, I strangled her with my hands, and then on the second floor in the bathroom, he dismembered the corpse with a kitchen knife. Oddly enough, the body of the young supermodel was found not far from Salonik's body in a wooded suburb of Athens, and the killers, from what they said in the newspaper article, did not stand on ceremony, which meant it was a very disgraceful burial. They had stuffed the remains into a suitcase and bag, after which they just kind of threw it in a shallow grave, and it was what it was, and her body was actually found 3 months later. So they had combed this particular area in search of stolen cars, which were hidden in various places by Albanian thieves, and they failed to find anything unusual until a local resident called the police after finding a rusty hunting rifle in the bushes. When law enforcement went there, they noticed a suitcase peeking out from under the ground. They thought that maybe some stray dogs had dug it up. So the police opened it, and it was the headless torso of a woman with no arms and no legs. And the shallow grave is only about 4 feet deep, 1.5 meters. They removed the suitcase, and head and limbs of the deceased girl were carefully placed, and they found a bath towel, and the insides were wrapped in it. So they not only cut off her arms, legs, and head, they also took out her bowels and wrapped them in a bath towel. A forensic doctor determined that the victim of unknown fanatics was about 20 years old. And despite the fact that the corpse had been underground for about 3 months, criminologists made attempts to take fingerprints from the deceased, and at the same time, through Interpol, they requested from the Russian police photographs of teeth, DNA, and fingerprints of Svetlana Kotova. This version was supported at least by the fact that the corpse was found about 1,000 feet or 300 meters from the Natasha Villa, and it was one of three villas rented by Salonik and his people. And the police saw a photograph of Svetlana, which relatives handed to Athens newspapers back in February, and considered that the similarity with the one they dug up was obvious. Soon after that, Sveta's parents were flown to Greece to identify her body. Before we get into a little bit more about Salonik, because we have this long testimony from his lawyer that kind of describes who Salonik was and how he was, and he was probably the person who knew him the best, I want to say. We're going to go ahead and take another short break, just a minute or two. We'll be right back here in a few. Hit fast forward or see you then. All right, so since the most reliable information about him is usually given by those people who knew him personally, his lawyer, Valery Karashev, he wrote a book about some of the people that he represented. The lawyer visited Greece and did conduct his own mini investigation there to find out what exactly happened. And here is his story. I began working with Salonik as a lawyer immediately after his delivery from the 20th City Hospital of the prison compartment of Matreskaya Tishina at the end of October 1994. He conducted all his affairs until his escape on July 5, 1995. We met almost every day. We talked about almost everything. He was, in general, an open person. I believe that I was able to create a fairly detailed psychological portrait of my client. He was very different from all the other representatives of the criminal world with whom I had to deal. He never drank alcohol, never smoked, never took drugs. He was always ready to take risks, but he always played it safe. But he had one weakness, women. He was a loving person and was very enthusiastic. Recently, before his arrest, he lived with the famous fashion model Natasha. She waited for him almost like the wife of a Decembrist. She wanted to become his full-fledged wife, although all of us, including Salonik, dissuaded her. At Natasha's insistence, my colleague Alexei Z flew to Tiemann to obtain a divorce from our client's second wife. I didn't know what happened between them after the escape, but they broke up. Now Natasha is married to some businessman. And yet I learned that his body was in a special police morgue. I found an informal way to go into his room with my interpreter and carefully examine the body. After plastic surgery and a clipper haircut, it was really difficult to recognize him, but the scars from a bullet wound in his back and kidney surgery left no doubt. It was Alexander Salonik. After returning to Russia, I told his mother about everything I saw. Until recently, she worked as a nurse in Kurgan. Having been issued a foreign passport, Valentina G. flew to Greece, took her son's body from the morgue, and buried him in the local cemetery. It must be said that the question of whether killer number one was really killed was of interest not only to law enforcement agencies, but also, to no less an extent, to criminal structures. Because a new redistribution of spheres of influence in Moscow is now ripe. Jap is under arrest in America, Mikas is in a Geneva prison, Pasha died in Lefortovo. Most of the biggest leaders have been neutralized. The main sniper of the upcoming redistribution could be Salonik. It was he who was able to dot the I's. When I started getting ready to go to Greece, somehow some criminals found out about this, and I received several calls asking me to thoroughly understand this matter and provide them with maximum information upon my return. To restore a complete picture of his life in Greece, I tried, through the Russian community, to find people with whom Salonik could have crossed paths. Here, people from Russia, Kazakhstan, Moldova, and Georgia are called Pontic Greeks. When widespread emigration to Greece began, all Pontic Greeks were given citizenship without any problems and given Greek surnames. So Salonik also left. His passport was genuine. So through my translator, also a Pontic Greek, I reached out to the Russian community. I noticed that at first, at the mere mention of the name Salonik, everybody literally shunned us. But gradually, I managed to establish contact with representatives of criminal structures who calmly enough said that they knew him, saw where he lived. The paradox is that, despite plastic surgery on the lower part of the face and the strictest observance of secrecy, Salonik did not always know how to keep his mouth shut. There was some kind of fanfare in it. I went to the Russian consulate. They diplomatically answered that since Salonik was Greek according to his passport, it means that the Russian authorities are not interfering in this matter. I contacted Interpol. They confirmed that they were monitoring him, but they refused to provide any information since I am a lawyer and not a representative of the intelligence service. I remember while still in prison during a meeting, Salonik unexpectedly blurted out to a defendant from another building, a member of one of the Moscow groups, that he was that same super killer. The news of this immediately spread throughout the prison, but he could have been killed there, since he initially confessed to the murder of several authorities and thieves in laws. Salonik had many blood relatives. In Greece, he had a passport in the name of Vladimir Kesov, and he often posed as a Russian consul. But in fact, many people knew who he was, according to information received in a private conversation from a representative of the Greek consulate. Shortly before this incident, a local nightclub dancer, a Russian girl, called the embassy, and Salonik actually gave up. The embassy immediately passed this information to the police. However, after my numerous meetings with local law enforcement officers, I came to the conclusion that the intelligence services knew about the presence of the fugitive superkiller here from the very beginning. For example, soon after his escape, Colonel Streletsky's people came here. Interpol also had all the necessary information on this matter. Each of these versions will be carefully examined in the book Salonik Mafia Executioner, which I am preparing for publication together with Moscow journalist Leonid Sherov. While still in the pre-trial detention center, Sasha repeatedly told me about the possibility of writing a book about him and even wanted an action-packed action movie to be made based on its materials. For some reason, he chose Nikita Mikhalkov for the role of director and invited me to begin relevant negotiations with him. A certain amount had already been allocated for the book and film, but the unexpected escape made significant adjustments to our plans. Communication with Salonik and other criminal leaders strengthened me in the idea that there is a secret organization of special services that is engaged in the physical destruction of criminal authorities. The fact is that, according to today's legal status of a thief in law, he cannot serve as a participant in any crime. He cannot kill, he cannot rob, he cannot bear arms. As they say in these circles, suit does not permit. He can only be an organizer, an arbitrator, or a treasurer of the common fund. In a word, it is almost impossible for law enforcement agencies to get close to thieves in law or authorities who often act only as ideologists of the criminal world. In general, Greece is literally crammed with Russian mafiosi. Some are on vacation, some are on the run, some are for permanent residence, because they have been cut off in Russia. At the parties where our bandits gather, in casinos, nightclubs, cafes, mainly on Ammonium Square, I recognized many of my former clients. Our brothers behave here quite peacefully and do not carry out any serious showdowns. Despite this, Russian groups already control several casinos, restaurants, and even large stores in Greece and Cyprus. Most of the Russian mafiosi, soon after the murder of Salonik, quickly left the country. Everyone understood that active investigation measures would follow, but luck smiled on me. The fact is that literally on the second day after my arrival, local newspapers reported that Salonik's lawyer had arrived in Greece to clarify the circumstances of the super killer's death. By the way, from the moment of my first visit to the police station, I immediately realized that I was under external surveillance. Two cars were constantly on my tail, and the stompers were not even hiding. In one of the cafes, a young man approached my translator and said, "Which can give us some information on the issue that interests us." The next day, an appointment was made. It turned out that the personal bodyguard of killer number one contacted me. He introduced himself as Kostya Grek and said that he came from Russia 5 years ago. In July 1995, his acquaintances received an offer to be a translator and at the same time a bodyguard for a Russian businessman. At first, Kostya had no idea that the businessman under his care was one of the most dangerous criminals in Russia. Arriving in Greece, Salonik was at first in complete inactivity. He was lying on a beach, swinging, swimming, sunbathing. In a word, he was resting. At first, he often changed villas, but feeling safe, he settled for a long time in one, in the Athens area. In the last months before his murder, Salonik had 3 rented villas at once. There was no point in buying them, since he was constantly moving. The average cost of renting a villa with a pool is from $5,000 to $10,000 a month. I visited all these houses, and they were not at all difficult to find. Salonik had a Mitsubishi Piero Jeep, and it was a rather expensive toy. In general, he was a real car enthusiast. At his request, I often brought car catalogs and auto review magazines to prison. He studied them with pleasure and could tell me for hours about the advantages of this or that model. He loved weapons just as passionately. Salonik was a great expert in this area. Before his arrest, he rented 2 neighboring apartments in Moscow, one of which was used entirely as an armory. When Listyev's murder occurred, Salonik was in jail. Despite this, on the same day, someone from a newly created investigative team came to him and asked, "Isn't this your work by any chance?" Salonik says, "Of course mine. I came out of the pretrial detention center, hit the TV guy, and came back." Okay. Can you tell me who did it?" Salonik said, "I can. This was done by those people who have long been dead." The fees of a killer of such a level of Salonik sometimes amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars. Often Alexander himself determined the price. After all, the costs of ordering are always justified. When someone is killed, the commercial structure that the deceased authority that was under the control will most likely pass to those who ordered the murder. Through his informants, Salonik found out what interests of commercial structures were affected as a result of his action, what economic effect his well-aimed shot gave, and based on the information collected, he adjusted the proposed amount. But sometimes, as Sasha said, he worked not for money, but for interests. Once, while discussing a television series with a lawyer, he said, "This is all nonsense. If they filmed my life, it would be a detective story. Only in the end, they would definitely kill me." Whew, fucking wild, man. His death is still shrouded in a little bit of mystery, and there are about three versions left. First version is that he was killed by people from the Secret Service. Second one is that he was eliminated by the Italian Mafia. And the third is it was ordered by Russian bandits, all those people, you know, that he had killed from different families that were made guys, like all of them got together and fucking killed him. Kostya Grek, his bodyguard before he passed away, he says that he backs up the Italian version because, according to him, Salonik was getting ready to go to Italy for a planned hit on a really, really big criminal figure. Believe it or not, at this point in time in the mid-90s, early 90s, there were Russians and all kinds of shit going on in Italy. So, consequently, the intelligence services only have access to illegal methods of putting pressure on leaders of the criminal community, contract killings, or artificially pitting one group against the other. Now, meanwhile, Greek law enforcement agencies did disagree with Kurashev's version, who was Salonik's lawyer. They found out that shortly before his death, Salonik attempted to kill the godfather of his native Kurgan mafia, a guy by the name of Asatrian, in one of the northern Greek cities. Despite the myth about a 100% guarantee of execution of any contract killings, this time luck was on Asatrian's side. He came out and actually did not die, supposedly the only person that Salonik failed a mission on. Now, after which, according to the police, he organized a conspiracy against his former colleague, and the police suggested that Salonik's murder was carried out by Sergei Kazhlev, the right hand of the leader of the Kurgan Mafia. Now, according to this version, his assistants in the Wet case, where Russian mafiosi Jim and Dima, who immediately after the death of the superkiller, together with Kazhlev, they left Greece in a hurry and never ever went there again. This, again, is just another version of whatever happened. All in all, Alexander Salonik probably took all his secrets to the grave. The man known as Alexander the Great, aka Superkiller, confessed to assassinating 43 Russian mobsters in the 1990s, but he never, ever, ever revealed who paid him to do these hits. So when he was confessing for all these murders, he never said one name about anybody who ever paid him to do them. So, like I said, there's a lot more questions going on than answers, unfortunately. You know, where did he learn to shoot like that? Was it from his competition shooting in high school, in the army? Who trained Salonik specifically? Who helped him out financially? We know that the Kurgan group did. He had all the weapons. Who was taking him around in all these foreign cities that he was going to? What was he doing in all these foreign cities? And we will just never know. So, let's talk about some sources here. One of which is the book by Valery Karashev, his lawyer. It's called Notes of a Bandit Lawyer, The Backstage Life of the Bratva Through the Eyes of the Mafia Defender. Got another article from Patrick Johnson, October 8, 2005, The Hitman Who Stalked Russia. The Life and Death of Russian Killer Number 1 from January 4th, 2003 from Pravda. Another article, Alexander Salonik, a.k.a. Makedonsky, and this is from Komprompta.ru. That's a Russian source. We have another article, Biography of Alexander Solonik, Criminal Authorities, Thieves in Law. This is from mzk1.ru. That's a Russian site. We have another article, The Hitmen Who Stalk Russia, BBC, from 2006. Article, Alexander Solonik, timenote.info. Article, Criminal Ukraine, What They Don't Talk About Out Loud, from 2019. Article, Is the Killer Alexander Solonik Alive? That's from a Russian source that I cannot fucking pronounce. Article, Greek witness in the Baikov case was taken to Krasna. Another Russian source, I can't pronounce that word. Another article, Russian of accused cop killer reported found in Athens, Moscow Times, February 5th, 1997. A book, Russian Crime, Who is Who? And they have a chapter on Alexander Solonik, a.k.a. Macedonian Alexander Maximov, EXMO Publishing House, 1997. Article, Alexander Solonik, the Cold-Blooded Russian Hitman Known as the Superkiller, by William DeLong, from 2018. Alexander Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia, and then a really good YouTube doc called Alexander Solonik, The Story of the Famous Killer. It's from the channel called A Different Story. Everything is in Russian, so you have to put on subtitles, then you have to hit the translation into English, and then you probably want to slow down the video to 0.75 as opposed to like full playback speed to catch a lot of that stuff. So there is that, and holy shit. Fucking A, finally done. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I know it took a long time, I always make excuses, what the fuck ever. This damn thing was harder than I thought to research. But, ways you can find me. Dude, just go on any social media and type in Mysterious Circumstances. I am not hard to find at all. X, @podcastmc. Instagram, Mysterious_podcast. I got email, justin.mcpodcast@gmail.com. I'm all over Facebook pages. You can follow my personal Instagram if you want. It's not hard to find either. Other than that, yeah. Hope you guys enjoyed. And it looks like from voting in the polls, the next episode up is going to be The Man in the Iron Mask. I do have a couple interviews coming out as well. I got to edit one. I just recorded one last week with the author of a book called Alcatraz Ghost Story. We had an awesome conversation. It's about a criminal who was locked up in Alcatraz, actually. But he does share a couple awesome stories about living in the Bay Area and Alcatraz and stuff like that, too. So, until next time, I will see you folks on the flip side.